You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, guys.
Hello, and we've convened unexpectedly, haven't we? We weren't going to give you a regular podcast this week, but some big news in the world of cycling this week. Team Lotto NL Jumbo have expelled three riders from their training camp for possessing non-approved sleep medication. Did you see that?
I did see that.
Yeah.
But it's maybe a good day to bury bad news for Lotto NL Jumbo. I don't know.
Which three riders?
Juan José Lobato, for one. Antoine Tolouc and Pascal Incorn. Or Encorn. So there you go. A serious violation of the stricter regulations of the team. But there has been other cycling news, hasn't there, this week? In a similar vein. No pun intended. Chris Froome reported adverse analytical finding from the Vuelta a España some months ago now, but it leaked and it was published in Le Monde and The Guardian this week on Wednesday. Lionel, can you just give us kind of summary of what's happened?
Chris Froome obviously won the Tour de France, won the Vuelta a España, and this case all centres around a test, a urine sample taken at the Vuelta after stage 18 to Santo Toribio de Liebana on September the 7th. Chris Froome has exercise-induced asthma and uses the asthma medication salbutamol, which is permitted without a TUE, a therapeutic use exemption, but only up to a limit of 1,600 micrograms in a 24-hour period. So basically, in layman's terms, that means Chris Froome and other asthmatics competing in cycling can use salbutamol. However, in terms of the urine test, the World Anti-Doping Agency's threshold for salbutamol is 1,000 nanograms per milliliter, and Froome's test on that particular day showed a concentration twice that of 2,000 nanograms per milliliter. Now, Richard, you used the phrase adverse analytical finding, and that's important because at the moment this is not a positive dope test, but it is something that Chris Froome and Team Sky have to take very seriously, and it could result in a ban. There is precedent for that, and we will talk about that a little bit later on. But we are currently in the position where Chris Froome has to explain to the UCI how the elevated levels of salbutamol got into that particular sample. It is worth pointing out that none of the other tests we gather at the moment or taken at the Vuelta require any extra explanation. So Chris Froome has come out and said that this is not a doping case, as of course Team Sky and Chris Froome would say, but coming on the back all the controversy about the TUEs and Bradley Wiggins last year, this is another case where we are solidly in the middle of the grey areas, I would say.
Indeed. I guess one of the questions that people have is, would we ever have known about this had The Guardian and Le Monde not published the story, not gone to the UCI, having been fed the information that this had happened with Froome? Froome himself has known since the day of the World Time Trial Championship, where of course he won a bronze medal behind Tom Dumoulin, which is remarkable. And some of you will have listened this week to our first French special of 2018, which, with exquisite timing, at home with the Froomes, Orla interviewed Michel Froome, I interviewed Chris Froome. And this episode was released just hours before this news broke. But we spent, you know, 3 or 4 hours with them in Monaco on October the 11th, so a few weeks after this happened, and they both appeared very, very relaxed. I mean, they didn't seem to have a care in the world. And I always find it remarkable that athletes are able to, I don't know, compartmentalize, or certainly carry on as if nothing's going on, and I don't know how Froome has been able to do that. This is a huge thing hanging over him. There's no guarantee that it would be resolved, but a lot of people uncomfortable, are they not, with the fact that it's only been made public thanks to some journalists on those newspapers.
That is true, Rich. I mean, you said a lot of people are asking the question, would we have ever known? Well, we wouldn't, because Sky had no intention of releasing any information about this, neither did the UCI, although in these cases the UCI are at liberty to confirm. If an allegation is put to them that a rider has returned an adverse analytical finding, they're at liberty to confirm the identity of the rider, but they are under no obligation within their kind of statutes, their rules, to of their own initiative announce that a rider has had this happen to them, which might make people uncomfortable. I think Tony Martin's got slightly the wrong end of the stick. The Katusha rider Tony Martin has come out and said that, you know, he suggested that it's wrong or scandalous that Froome was able to carry on competing and that this was all happening behind the scenes. In these cases, that's perfectly legitimate, as I understand it. What is interesting is that there has been no provisional suspension of Chris Froome, either by the team or the UCI. The UCI don't have to suspend Chris Froome provisionally in these cases, although it's a positive A and B sample that he's returned already. But the team could have. And why would they have done that? Well, if Chris Froome does get banned, his ban will start on the date of the announcement of the sanction. In previous cases, bans have been backdated and they've started from the moment when the rider or the team have suspended the rider, or the rider has suspended himself. I mean, that happened last year with Simon Yates when he also tested positive for an asthma medication that should have been justified by a TUE. He had the TUE, but they'd forgot to include it on the anti-doping form, or they'd forgot to specify the substance. But he suspended himself straight away, and which was to his advantage later on, because he'd effectively almost served his ban by the time the sanction was announced. In Chris Froome's case, this might go on, this whole process of him trying to explain why he'd gone over the salbutamol threshold might go on for several months, at which point, after several months, the UCI might announce that he's banned. And if you look at the dates and the timeline and you just kind of speculate, looking at previous cases, how long a ban could be, if it was 6 months, for example, or 6 months from yesterday was the 13th of June, so obviously just before the Tour de France, this case I don't think is going to be resolved in the next 2 weeks. So if, for example, the UCI announced in a month that Chris Froome's ban was going to be 6 months, then he would not be eligible to ride the Tour de France. Another possibility, looking at how long these cases have taken in the past, is that we get to the Giro d'Italia next year or the Tour de France next year, and he's still not provisionally suspended by Sky, and he's still not suspended by the UCI, and he can compete and start in those races. And we obviously get a pretty unsatisfactory situation like we've had in the past with Alberto Contador, who rode a Giro d'Italia and won a Giro d'Italia with the threat of a ban hanging over him, and that ban was subsequently confirmed and he was stripped of the results. So I don't think anyone really wants that to happen. And there's the Chris Froome and his entourage have been given no clear timeline on how long this process might take. It could take weeks, it could take months.
The process, am I not right in thinking that the process is in the hands of Froome and his entourage? It's up to him now to demonstrate how such elevated quantities of salbutamol were in his body. It's kind of the opposite of under strict liability with anti-doping case with positive tests. The athlete has to prove that there's an assumption then of guilt. You know, the athlete has to prove this is the opposite.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Rich. And, you know, the problem that Froome has got is that, as I understand it, he has quite a sort of strict regimen of when he takes his asthma medication and different kind of levels of how much he needs to take. And this is, if you like, the sort of the top level of on that particular day he took the most he would ever take, but that was not the only day in the Vuelta, or was not the only day, for example, last season or in his career when he's taken that amount of his inhaler. But you've got this huge outlier, this one result. Every other result we presume was under the threshold, and this one result which is way over the limit. But now he's in the position where he has to prove why that was. It's not enough to say to the UCI, well, something must have gone wrong here, either with the test or, you know, with my metabolism. They have to say what went wrong. Sky or Team Chris Froome have to prove what went wrong and why it went wrong. And you know, where do you start with that? They, you know, just looking back at previous cases, and we'll talk later about the Alessandro Petacchi case, I think, and unless there's, they can provide a very, very detailed explanation of exactly why there was that amount of salbutamol in his urine, it might not cut any ice with the UCI's doping tribunal.
Should just point out, going back to the Vuelta, and I remember, well, I arrived back on the race at Chris Froome's press conference, which was on the rest day, the final rest day of the race, and you know there was a bit of kind of gossip at the time about whether or not Froome was coughing more than normal, and it does appear certainly in Froome and Team Sky's initial reactions to this news becoming public, they're saying that his asthma symptoms were worsening during that period, and it is important to point out that, you know, they have said that they increased the amount of salbutamol that Froome was taking in consultation with the Team Sky doctor, but they maintain, Froome maintains, that he didn't exceed the permitted dose, the amount allowed by the World Anti-Doping Agency's rules. And so you're absolutely right, Daniel, this is going to hinge on that bit of science between taking the dose of the medicine and the trace that shows up in a urine sample, and that will, I suspect, I don't want to sort of speculate on the science of this because, well, I'm not a science, I'm not a medic, but it's going to hinge on, you know, how the body absorbed and processed the substance on that particular day and why the result was different, and enough to trip the wire in this case and not on the other days. So it's going to be, I would suggest, you're absolutely right, a lengthy and quite difficult case to get to the bottom of.
Another thing that's worth pointing out, Lionel, perhaps, is parallel with the Simon Yates case, different substances, slightly different circumstances. However, he was shown some clemency because it was acknowledged by the UCI Doping Tribunal that there had been an error on the part of the doctor, the team doctor in question. He'd forgotten to specify a substance on the anti-doping form that Simon Yates was allowed to take. In this case, nothing I've heard, read, or seen suggests that Team Sky are going to throw a team doctor under the bus, as it were, and suggest that Froome was giving the wrong advice or the wrong dose by the doctor in that final week of the Vuelta, thereby leading to him having a high concentration of salbutamol in his urine.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, RAFA exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much to our main sponsor, RAFA, for backing Cycling Podcasts all year. They enable us to produce these weekly free podcasts. Thank you very much to them. I mentioned at the start that we've also just launched our Friends of the Podcast program for 2018. Episode 1 is out. The Froome's at Home. Unmissable. And we're going to actually release episode number 2 very, very soon. I think next week, early next week, Lionel. Is that the plan?
I think so. Yeah, why not? Why not?
Yeah, why not? Mm. Give people something to listen to over Christmas. And that's going to be Look, Lunch with Matt White. So we had lunch with Matt White recently in London, and a very, very candid discussion indeed over an hour. And I think it's a really interesting listen. Covers his own career as a rider and more recently as a sports director at Orica.
Does he cover, Rich, his own positive test for
salbutamol?
For salbutamol. Adverse analytical finding.
In 1998. He does. He got a 2-month ban for that, is that right? He certainly covers his doping in a lot of detail. And at the first Giro that he rode in 1998 as well, the Giro won by Marco Pantani, it's really quite grisly at times, but fascinating and a really good listen, I think. So that is released next week. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Fair to say that I think salbutamol was the very least of... I mean, amazing that he got done for salbutamol when everything else that was doing at the time. But anyway, I guess we're going to talk about precedents, aren't we, in this part? You've been looking into that, Daniel. I mean, I contacted Jeroen Swart yesterday, the sports scientist in South Africa who's involved in anti-doping in South Africa. And he's worked with Froome before, of course, on the test that he did in the lab a few years ago. I was keen to know the answers to basic questions. Is salbutamol performance enhancing? If you're taking salbutamol for asthma, does an increased dose bring extra benefits? Any way to take it other than by inhaler? Can it work in conjunction with any other drugs? Some of those answers became clear yesterday. It is listed in the WADA code as a potential masking agent, but doesn't seem to be any evidence of it being used as a masking agent. Jeroen said that there have been a few studies that have shown performance-enhancing effects, but those are balanced by a whole bunch of studies that show no benefit. I mean, the thing that struck him as most surprising, really, was the size of the quantity of subutamol in his system on that one particular day. And Froome has given an interview today to Orla Chenoui about it all, and he has said that there have been no other occasions when he's been over the threshold for subutamol in his career. So one of the things we wondered was, you know, has this happened before and we've not known about it? You know, is it quite a regular occurrence? We don't know. He certainly says that he has never had this happen before and that he's never taken subutamol in any form other than by inhaler. It's a really, really curious one. I mean, on the possibility of some strange reaction in his body, maybe dehydration, whatever. Jeroen said it wasn't dehydration, but it's the lack of renal blood flow that can cause very concentrated urine that could perhaps produce a freak result like this. But again, you know, Sky monitor their riders' levels of dehydration very closely. You know, there was that story a couple of years ago of a Froome urine sample being found outside a hotel door, wasn't there? So they would know, you know, certainly daily, at least daily, the state of their riders' hydration. So they must have, you would think, records of all that as well.
Well, just on that, Rich, we were going to talk about precedents. And one case that was very extensively documented was the Alessandro Petacchi case in 2007. He had a similar sort of adverse analytical finding, slightly less salbutamol in his system, 1,300 and something nanograms, as opposed to Froome's 2,000, with the threshold being 1,000. And just on the question of, you know, the concentration in the urine, one of the arguments that Petacchi made, and he was originally absolved, and then that decision, so he was absolved by his own federation, and that decision was contested by his National Olympic Committee, so CONI and WADA, and his defense team, Petacchi's, suggested that what should have been taken into account was something called the specific urine gravity, urine specific gravity. Now this is very uncomfortable for me because anything to do with toilets and, is always tough for me to talk about, but that is basically the ratio of water in the urine. He was told, or in the summing up of the case when the decision was actually overturned and he did get a ban, that the WADA code only stipulates that naturally the specific urine gravity is only taken into account when the test is for endogenous, so naturally produced substances, and that it couldn't be taken into account in this case. And I mean, the wider point from that again is that Chris Froome is going to have to, the burden of proving his innocence is all on him and his team. He's not going to get any help here from the UCI and their anti-doping tribunal and their scientific experts. It's all down to him and to prove that there was that amount of salbutamol in his urine for good reason, for a legitimate reason.
So if we look at the previous cases, and you mentioned Alessandro Petacchi there, Daniel, that was back in 2007, wasn't it? A test taken at the Giro d'Italia where he won several stages. Initially, he was stripped of those wins and then reinstated, and then the Court of Arbitration for Sport finally upheld the decision and he was stripped officially of those victories. A more recent case, another Italian rider, Diego Ulissi, again during the Giro d'Italia, this time in 2014, elevated levels of salbutamol. Again, not as high as Chris Froome's, I don't think, and he was suspended for 9 months and stripped of results from that period. So obviously, if Chris Froome and Team Sky can't demonstrate that they didn't exceed the dose, then we could be looking at a similar scenario, couldn't we?
One thing I think that bears pointing out here is that there was quite a big change in the way the UCI administers its doping cases in January of 2015 when the bodies deciding on the sanctions for athletes and effectively processing the cases, up until that point they were the national federations in every country. And that's one of the reasons I think why you had so much variation between the sanctions that were given to different riders. I mean, Ulisi got 9 months in the end, but he had a Swiss license and it was the Swiss sanctioning body. I'm not sure whether it's the Cycling Federation or the Olympic Committee, but he got his sanctions there from Switzerland, and with Pataki it was Italy and so forth. Since January 2015, it is the UCI's anti-doping tribunal that decides on all of the sanctions. Now, the UCI didn't appeal the Ulisi decision. They didn't appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which suggests that they were roughly, broadly in agreement with the sanction there. It strikes me as being a fairly similar case, the Ulisi case, similar quantity of salbutamol. What will be different is that you would think that Sky and Froome will have, I'm not going to say better lawyers on the case, but they'll have more robust kind of legal machinery behind this. And the other big difference was that Lamprey, Ulisi's team, suspended him provisionally straight away. So again, he ended up in the advantageous position whereby he had served most of his ban by the time that he was actually sort of found guilty, as it were. And he didn't try to contest the decision. He didn't go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. If the UCI does ban Froome and he decides that he does want to go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, there, I think, again, he's in a bit of an invidious position, because Court of Arbitration for Sport uses a lot of, it bases a lot of its decisions on precedents, and there's one very, very clear precedent that they've got with Pataki. And again, looking through his case, it doesn't make particularly comfortable reading for Froome, I wouldn't suggest.
All of which makes it so surprising that Froome has appeared, at least from the outside, to have been able to go about his business with a relaxed mind. And you know, only last week or 2 weeks ago, he confirmed that he was going to the Giro d'Italia next year in a video. And, you know, he certainly, it seems to have been business as usual and training. He's training Mallorca at the moment and planning for next year, as though he appeared quite unperturbed by it and unconcerned that there would be a punishment and a ban. That strikes a lot of people as odd, I think.
I mean, without straying into areas of speculation and trying to second guess somebody's mindset, I mean, it could be explained by two things. One, as Daniel said, you know, they wouldn't have necessarily had an expectation that this would be made public. And secondly, you know, Chris Froome, he's got asthma, exercise-induced asthma, how he describes it. He has taken salbutamol for a long time. Think back to the Tour of Romandy a few years ago when he was riding in the front group and the TV cameras picked him up taking a puff on his inhaler. That was a kind of almost a watershed moment, certainly in terms of public perception, because a lot of people thought, well, hang on a minute, what's going on here? And I certainly learned a lot about, you know, asthma drugs and asthma in sport as a result of that. My initial reaction was that this just looks terrible. And then, of course, people working within sport saying, well, you know, do we create a place where asthmatics cannot compete in sport, and that would be hugely damaging for a large number of people. And so, you know, that was when this kind of whole complex area first certainly crossed my mind anyway, because prior to that, my perception had been, well, you know, everyone who's a registered asthmatic in sport, you know, that the cynic in me would say, this is crazy. I mean, how are all these asthmatics among the greatest sports people in the world? And so that was something that certainly changed my perceptions of this. But now we are in a position where, you know, Chris Froome obviously feels that he has done absolutely nothing wrong. But certainly the reporting gives a very different impression. I mean, the headline on the BBC 6 o'clock news was as clear as day. Chris Froome has failed a drugs test. And, you know, we can argue about the semantics of that, but that is the situation that we're in, and that is how it looks. And in terms of this fight, it's certainly not going to get any clearer anytime soon. I suspect it will get it will get more difficult to understand before we reach a conclusion and get to an answer.
Just a little bit on that, Lionel. It was actually the Dauphiné rather than Tour de Romandie where he was photographed using the inhaler.
Just on that, on the use of an inhaler in the race, this was something that, again, was in Pataki's defence, that on the particular day when he tested positive, he tried to use his inhaler during the race, and his defence team speculated that he could have... I don't really know how this would happen. I've never used an inhaler, but he could have swallowed some of the medication instead of inhaled it, as you normally would. And they also said that not enough attention was paid in the arbitration of this case to inhalation technique, which could have a big effect on the amount of salbutamol in someone's urine. And but again, this was thrown out. This was not accepted. It was the Court of Arbitration for Sport panel accepted that this might have happened, but it was ultimately still Pataki's fault, and he bore strict liability.
On the subject of the prevalence of asthmatics in sport, and especially when you're talking about exercise and just asthma, I've never been too surprised about that. It strikes me that, and you hear all the time, that professional athletes, contrary to the myth that they are, you know, perfect specimens in incredible health all the time, they're on the brink of illness and injury all the time. I mentioned earlier when we were chatting that, you know, footballers are more likely to have cruciate ligament injuries than general members of the population. It strikes me that the stress and the strain that athletes are putting their lungs under means that there will be a greater incidence of exercise-induced asthma in elite athletes. And I think it's right about 20%, isn't it, of elite athletes have asthma of some kind. And to me, that sort of makes sense, I think.
Yeah, and Chris Froome has used an inhaler since he was a teenager, long before he became an elite and professional athlete. So, you know, it's an uncomfortable area, because the last thing we really want to be saying is that certain medical conditions are prohibit you from taking part in elite sport. So it's a very tricky case. And I think really, when in the final analysis, our colleague Francois Thomazeau, who always makes the point that doping in sport is a legal matter rather than an ethical or moral one, the facts will decide. The limit has been exceeded, and the precedent is there, as Daniel says, and it will be up to Chris Froome and Team Sky to argue their way to avoiding a suspension, I suspect.
You were living a secret life, you were. And you had to hide things from loved ones, and you had to hide things from mates at home, or because it's certainly not socially acceptable to use performance-enhancing drugs. And I think for me, the biggest liberating factor, I think, when I did confess, end of 2012 there, I was really thrown under the bus by the Australian media, which is fine. I take full responsibility for what I did. But I was the first Australian in any of those sports who actually did say they were involved in any kind of doping. So it was a big story, because Australians are very, very... Our moral standards with sport is very, very high. Same as it is here in the UK, that, you know, doping and professional sport or elite sport should not and ever mix. And I think Australians in general were very ignorant, really, to the fact that professional sport cannot always be a healthy place, where there's people able to make lots of money, there's people willing to take risks. Unfortunately, that's human nature. I was on the back page of the biggest newspaper in Australia with Drug Cheat. I was the back page.
Become a friend of the podcast and get at least 11 exclusive in-depth episodes for just £15. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up for 2018.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. And of course, as ever, you can get 20% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code CPAUG20. Thank you to them. Lionel, you mentioned Francois Thomazeau. I mean, it's so murky, it's so lacking in clarity. And you know, the public and the media, they like their doping stories to be very black or white, similar to the perception that, you know, people are either good or evil. We like things to be simple, and this certainly isn't simple. But Francois Thomazeau, our colleague, does have a great way of cutting through the BS at times, doesn't he? And to quote his tweet this morning, and he has said this about a million times, doping is not about morals, it's not about health, it's not even about performance enhancement. It's about respecting rules. Did Chris Froome break rules in the past TUE cases? No. This time, yes. That's a good way of just bringing some clarity, whether you agree or not. Francois's been always very firm in that view that doping is not a moral issue, it's a legal issue, and it's about the rules and about, you know, applying the rules. And under his strict interpretation, it would appear that Chris Froome, whether he gained any kind of performance advantage or not, has transgressed the rules.
Well, yeah, Rich, but it's also written in the rules that Froome has the right of kind of reply and defence before he receives any kind of sanction or penalty. I mean, everyone is, of course, at liberty to feel what they want about this, but I think you do have to bear in mind that, as Francois says, the current anti-doping system is based on legality, not ethics. I mean, the only thing that matters here materially is the UCI's judgment on the case and whatever happens after that as regards appeals. But just to bear that out, Sky and Froome might actually end up on the right side of the sort of ethical divide here, but the wrong side of it legally. I mean, that's exactly what happened with Pataki. In their summing up, the Court of Arbitration for Sport panel said that they were satisfied he wasn't a cheat, but that ultimately didn't matter and that a rule of strict liability applied.
Yeah, again, though, in terms of the rules, I mean, the rules are, there's two kind of parallel tracks to it, aren't there? There's the dosage that you're not allowed to exceed, which is 1600 micrograms, and then there is the trace of the substance in a urine sample, which is not allowed to exceed 1,000 nanograms per milliliter. So, and obviously, people who know far, far more about it than us have drawn up that rule based on, I would assume, you know, huge or a large number of cases, and have come up with those parameters for good reason. So it could well be, as you rightly say, Daniel, Chris Froome may not have exceeded the dose permitted, and that's what he says, and yet his sample exceeds the permitted trace allowed in a sample. So there is a real sort of complexity to this that he could well have stuck within the rules and yet has fallen outside of the rules when you come to sort of evaluate things at the other end. So it's not a simple case, and it's not going to be a simple one to resolve, I wouldn't have thought.
No, and how on earth can Sky explain, again, not to suggest that they upped the dose to illegal levels, but they're in the difficult position where they have to explain why every other day, or even on days when he took the same amount of the substance that he's allowed to take, and he was under the threshold, and then suddenly he was over it, he was double the limit. And they're going to submit a lot of documentation over the next few weeks, I think, but... I think the last resort in these cases is something called pharmacokinetic testing or pharmacokinetic testing, whereby the rider will be possibly even in Egle at the UCI headquarters. They'll undergo a series of tests and they'll try to recreate the conditions he was riding in at that time. But, you know, I imagine that would be very difficult to replicate, you know, the exact weather conditions and the state of fatigue and so forth and so forth at the end or in the third week of a Grand Tour. And as I say, I think that is a last resort for Froome and Sky, and they probably won't want it to go that far. And if it does go that far, I would sort of suggest they're in a pretty bad position.
Just to contradict Francois, but who says it's not about performance enhancement, but, you know, for most of us, doping equals performance enhancement. It's about trying to get an unfair advantage. And that is central to this as well. You know, would the salbutamol have given Froome an unfair advantage? Would he have deliberately taken more of it to try and gain an unfair advantage? It doesn't stack up.
Well, my argument about that is always the same. I mean, if you're, and this is where it's so difficult when it comes to a medical condition. I mean, let's take a completely unrelated issue. You know, if you have a knee injury and you can't bend your knee, and then you can take a you know, cortisone and then suddenly can bend your knee. Well, on the one hand, that is restoring your knee to full extension and what have you, and restoring you back to health, so you can carry on cycling. On the other hand, it's enhancing your performance from a position where you can't even pedal to a position where you can pedal.
Enabling your performance.
It's enabling your performance, of course. It's enabling, okay.
But that's the grey area isn't it?
That is the grey area, isn't it? Because enabling, that is the kind of the holy grail of all sports people, isn't it? And we've said this so many times on the podcast. The holy grail is to be able to compete at their top level every day, and they kind of know intuitively, and in this era of sports science, they know down to the numbers what their maximum performance is, and anything that compromises that performance, whether it be illness or injury or what have you, is almost seen as kind of like, well, that's inhibiting me, and that is holding me back. And of course, the flip side to that, the great contradiction of the Grand Tours, is that the whole purpose of it is who comes through the best, who survives the best, who is almost the last man standing, who can cope with the adversity and the...
A test of health, as you said. A test of health, exactly. As we've said many times. But the related point is that the ease with which salbutamol can be detected in urine. So if Froome had deliberately overdosed on salbutamol, he would have done so knowing that he was going to be tested and knowing that as Jeroen said, that it would be found. It would be, in his words, career suicide. That's what doesn't make sense.
No, and it strikes me as a very contentious issue, the whole salbutamol issue, and something that might well be revised on the back of what is going to be a very high-profile case like this one. I mean, even going back to the mid-90s and with Miguel Indurain, when he had an adverse, I think it was called a positive test back then, or they called it a positive test for salbutamol, at the Tour de l'Oise, and the UCI's rules said that salbutamol wasn't banned, and then the French Federation rules said that it was, and that was very contentious again. And it seems to me to be a bit of a murky area.
So what does it mean for Team Sky, Lionel?
Oh, it's very difficult for Team Sky. I mean, of all the teams that... That would face this, they are the best equipped probably to answer the case. I mean, we talked a bit about Diego Ulissi and Lamprey. You know, a smaller team would perhaps not have the financial, legal wherewithal to take this all the way, which you imagine just from the way that Froome and Sky have set out initially. I mean, that Daniel makes a great point. They haven't, you know, they haven't suspended Chris Froome or said that he won't, you know, they will carry on as normal while this case goes on in the background. And so in terms of the team best equipped to deal with this, Sky are probably the best team equipped to deal with it. But in terms of perception and, you know, the public image of the team, I think already we've seen on social media people who think that Sky stray over the lines and, you know, use the previous cases, the Bradley Wiggins TUE, even Sergio Henao and the biological passport discrepancies or irregularities that had to then be researched, and then Henao was cleared and returned to racing. You know, there's for some people, there is a kind of a greater pattern here. I think that... I don't blame people for looking at this and joining all these cases together and thinking it's just, you know, it's just kind of the cost of doing business for Team Sky.
But you made a great point, Daniel, before we started recording, when we were chatting about this, about, you know, that whenever anything like this comes up with Team Sky, we always hold them to a higher standard, and that's perhaps their own fault, but we probably have to move beyond that at some point.
Well, again, it's this issue, Rich, of I don't claim that anyone should react or feel a certain way about any of this. I just know that from my point of view and from our point of view, as people have been covering this for a very long time now, it's difficult to get too het up when you've come from an era and come from a world when people were talking about, you know, doing three blood bags in a Tour de France and EPO and so forth and so forth. It's quite difficult to wring your hands about an asthma medication. And also, you kind of brutalize, you know that teams come and go, riders come and go, eras come and go, but the whole circus sort of it rolls on. And I suppose as part of that, when Team Sky launched and when they made all these grandiose promises about being very clean and very transparent, I suppose people, maybe like you and I, took that less seriously than the kind of general sports media or general fan who had not been watching cycling so closely for you know, the previous decade or two decades. And you know, we, and also very quickly, within a year, 2 years, Sky sort of transitioned, in my eyes and in the way they behaved and in everything about them, into a normal team. They were no longer, or they, if they ever had been, this team that came onto the scene in the same way that, for example, Slipstream did, making transparency and being clean and never having any kind of issue of this nature their USP. But some people obviously do still consider them to have made that promise, and some people still obviously hold them to that promise.
I think we kind of moved from a, maybe this is optimistic or naive perhaps, but we've moved from a doping model to a medical model, haven't we?
Correct.
And
correct.
And it's not, you know, professional sport is highly medicalized, and that might inevitably bring athletes close to that line. You know, this is a whole other debate which we've had quite often, and no doubt we'll have it again. But I think that the at the moment, the murkiness of this, the fact that it's not likely to be resolved anytime soon, leaves us all feeling pretty uncomfortable. And especially if we go to the Giro next year and Chris Froome is there and the case is unresolved, really echoes of 2011 when Contador was in the same situation and, you know, went to the Giro, won the Giro, went to the Tour de France, and all these results, all these performances were eventually wiped from the record books. And we don't want that situation again, but it's with a sense of dread that we can sort of anticipate it, I think.
Just as a last word, Rich, again, you know, the point about legality and not morality is a valid one. Unfortunately, this is a, we live in a kind of adult world, and this is, and it's a complicated, it's a very complicated sport, and these are complicated rules, and you know, our reactions to it almost have to mirror how nuanced these cases are. And you know, when I see things like yesterday, reactions like, "Oh, that, I'm done with professional cycling. That's it for me." Well, I think if you do react in that way, you're going to continue to be upset if you do keep watching it, because you know these cases are going to come and go. And again, like I said, teams are going to come and go, eras are going to come and go, disciplinary cases are going to come and go, and you have to have a pretty thick skin to follow this sport.
You do. Shall we leave it there? We'll be back next week, Lionel. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rich. Are we going to put the Cassoulet podcast out at any point, or is that going to go?
Yeah,
on
next
the...
week. Next
okay,
week.
Good.
Well, Cassoulet for Christmas.
Brand.
What were Lionel's? How many nanograms of duck fat were in Lionel's last urine sample?
Oh, he was way over the threshold.
Over the, yeah, I mean, it wasn't measured in nanograms; It was measured in pints, Daniel.
Yeah, we've got Cassoulet next week, and also the Matt White episode, which on this subject of these different eras and how things have changed is really interesting too. So I recommend that for your Christmas listening. We've got an episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina coming out next week as well. So a busy week. But for the moment, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Rick.